A person who really tries to do good, like I'm doing, sometimes steps on the toes of those in the power structure. And then the local power structure strikes back. Hurtful things can be said, but as for those who speak lies against me, I forgive them. Beltether said nothing, but his pen never stopped. Colikin added, In fact, the exact same thing once happened to a famous man named Jesus. Wouldn't you agree? Grigori kept muttering to himself and shaking his head as the helicopter cut across Syrian airspace. They could see the troops massing on the ground below. Then they passed over several crashed fighter jets. They couldn't tell at first who they belonged to. There were smoldering piles of smashed aircraft and trails of black smoke spiraling up from the wreckage. Then they spotted a parachute on the ground. It was dancing and rippling in the wind. Nearby was an injured Israeli pilot surrounded by enemy troops.
Hey, I think that's a downed Israeli, Joshua cried out.
Forget about it, Grigori shouted.
The Georgian pilot was gesturing wildly.
Lucky we don't get shot, boom, boom, right out of sky.
Nobody was going to debate the point. Joshua and the team had all been waiting for the first missiles to come flying. After all, they were passing through a war zone. Grigori and his co-pilot checked their bearings.
Okay, soon be leaving Syria and crossing Israel border. Golan Heights coming up. Pick up point dead ahead. Thanks for flying Georgian Airlines, Grigori laughed.
Now the fear was that the Israelis would blow them out of the sky. As they crossed into Israel, they saw the multiple lines of barbed wire fence along the DMZ corridor as they followed the brown rolling hills on the Golan Plateau. The barren landscape was dotted with yellow and red signs warning of landmines. They passed over a defensive line of Israeli anti-aircraft guns and makeshift bunkers where the IDF was dug in along the border. As the helicopter passed, the soldiers scrambled to their posts. Grigori pointed to the long barrel of the big gun that was being wheeled around to track them. He started swearing loudly in his mother tongue. They waited, but no incoming fire, nothing.
Thank you, God, Joshua muttered.
So the Georgians are friendly with Israel, after all, Cannon said with a smile. A few miles past the last Israeli defensive outpost, they came to an open plateau surrounded by a few scruffy trees. On the ground was an Israeli Black Hawk helicopter. The rotors were slowly idling, cutting the air. They could see a pilot in the cockpit. Joshua peered down. Only one pilot? Cannon joined in.
Oh, looks like the newer generation, the faster ones. Doesn't need a three-man team like the older models.
Grigori started bringing his big helicopter down about 50 yards from the Black Hawk. When they were on the ground, Grigori turned and said,
Joshua Jordan, I want you know something. That I read about you. I know all about you. You're good man. You have big luck, okay?
Joshua stepped up to shake his hand, and his co-pilots too. Then he grabbed the hands of each of the four special ops guys, one by one. I owe my life to every one of you. I'll never forget what you did. Joshua had a momentary hesitation as he studied the faces of the four Americans. Was it a fear for their safety or for his own? Jack said, Be safe.
Godspeed, Colonel Jordan, Cannon said.
Then he saluted. Joshua saluted back and then slid down from the helicopter and started jogging toward the Black Hawk. The Georgian copter lifted straight up in a whirl of dust. By the time Joshua reached the Black Hawk, Grigori had piloted the commercial helicopter out of sight. Joshua climbed into the open door and sat in the passenger seat. The pilot had the sun visor of his helmet down. There was a smile on his face, but something didn't seem right. Joshua glanced behind the pilot's seat. A tarp was spread out over something. He looked again. Two fingers of some dead man's hand were sticking out. When Joshua looked back, the pilot was pointing a handgun directly at Joshua's chest. The pilot flipped his sun visor up. Suddenly, Joshua felt a queasy feeling of weightlessness and the shock of recognition as he stared at the face of the deadly assassin in the pilot's seat. When Atta Zimler addressed his stunned passenger, there was an oily tone of arrogance to his voice.
Good to see you again, Joshua Jordan.
Sorry to leave you so abruptly last year at the train station in New York, but I had to slip away before your idiot police and FBI got any closer. You had to know I would never give up. Zimmler was enjoying himself. That I would come after you, no matter how long it took. That I would never allow you to win. Admit it. You knew deep down it would come to this. Shortly, you are going to give me your computer password to the RTS design files, which will then make me obscenely rich. Then Zimmler gave a wave with his 45 caliber Glock 39. So, come on. Let me hear you say the words. Mr. Zimmler, sir, you win.
Chapter 64. The first third of the Russian Islamic Coalition ground troops had already poured over the northern border of Israel and were massing south of Tel Dan. Hundreds of Russian tanks, mobile missile launchers, and troop transport trucks were smashing their way toward the main highways that would take them south through the heart of Israel and on to Jerusalem. Mobs of Hezbollah gunmen had joined the invasion along the way. In other suburbs near the border, they had surrounded homes and hit them with unending mortar fire to help the invasion. Now the Russian and Turkish tanks were rumbling past them, and the Palestinian terror groups were screaming in delight and cheering them on till they were hoarse. The downfall of Israel was imminent. The word in Jerusalem was that enemy troops would be at the outskirts of the city by nightfall. Thousands of Orthodox Hasidim had swarmed to the western wall in the Old City section. A sea of black coats moved rhythmically in prayers from the Nusach Sephard. Their prayer locks slowly bobbed as their voices cried out to God, weeping, pleading. One rabbi broke from the prayer book recitation. The cry of his voice was from the book of Job. Terrors are turned upon me. They pursue my soul as the wind, and my welfare passes away like a cloud. And now my soul is poured out upon me. The days of affliction have taken hold upon me. Those were the words of his mouth, but his heart was crying out, When, O God, when will your strong arm show itself? In the Mediterranean, the huge troop transport ships were only 3 miles from the beaches of Tel Aviv and the port of Haifa. The Israeli fighter jets had mounted a valiant attempt to destroy the ships, but the Russian MiGs were too many. The Israeli Air Force had been compromised by having to send their fighters simultaneously to defend all four of their borders against overwhelming forces. Now the IDF jets were arriving only sporadically, coming at the massive armada in squadrons of three. They were trying to hit the ships with missiles and were spraying their decks with machine gun fire. But the MiGs, in groups of a dozen at a time, would descend on them and chase them off. Hundreds of amphibious launches, all of them crammed with soldiers from Russia, the Slavic Republics, and Turkey, were ready to begin motoring from the ships to the Israeli coast. All they needed now was the go signal from the naval command. But for some reason, that message had been delayed. At the bottom of Syria, near the Israeli border, General Viktor Oragov was in an armored staff vehicle at the back of the invading army. He was on his satellite phone with a group of scientists in Moscow. When he clicked off, he turned to the major sitting next to him. Send the message to the front immediately. We are holding our positions. No advance. Not yet. We wait. Turkish General Ismet in the back seat couldn't fathom it. He leaned over the seat. Why? We can't afford to waste time and give the Jews more time to regroup. We have them on the ground with our boots on their necks. Wait. No, this is not good. I'm in command, Oragov barked. Just 15 minutes. Then I'll get the word back from Moscow and we can proceed.
Word about what?
Oragov couldn't tell him, not yet. The snafu he had just discussed on the phone was almost laughable, but the high command in the Kremlin insisted they had to sort out some data first, about some absurd concern that the scientists and eggheads must have cooked up. Oragov thought it was bunk, but he couldn't tell that to his Turkish counterpart. So he played along with his superiors in Moscow. General Oragov looked at his watch. If he didn't hear back in 14 minutes, he was giving the order for the land invasion to resume, with or without Moscow's approval. So,
the 80-mile-long caravan of military equipment and troops, stretching from Syria and into the north of Israel, came to a halt. The invasion forces on the Syrian side near the Golan Heights and in Jordan also stopped, waiting for General Orogov's order to continue the merciless attack. The invading forces from Libya and the Sudan, which had begun rolling through the crowds of cheering Palestinians in Gaza, were about to start assaulting the perimeter of IDF military defenses around the suburbs of Jerusalem. The line of the invading Libyan-Sudanese armies stretched back through Gaza all the way to the Sinai Desert on the Egyptian side. But they were also ordered to halt, waiting for General Orogov. The war, at least for the next few minutes, had come to a strange, eerie pause. In Hawaii, Dr. Robert Hamilton sat in his office. He felt sick. His wife had urged him to go home after his chemo treatment. Just the day before, he had received a belated invitation that should have lifted his spirits. He was being given a small slot at the next global warming conference in Buenos Aires to address his controversial theories. But that is not where his mind was. Instead, it was on the most recent computer data in front of him. He pushed the pile of papers away and turned to Finley, his young assistant. Hamilton pointed at the stack of printouts. "Is this accurate?" Finley nodded, still slack-jawed at the readings that he himself had first detected. "Where's the center of this thing? It's so big that I can't even isolate it." Hamilton picked up the phone and quickly dialed a number in Washington, D.C. He demanded to talk to the chief meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Maybe he would listen. He was put on hold. When the secretary got back on the phone, she told him the chief was not available. He was addressing a climate convention in Chicago. Dr. Hamilton screamed into the phone. "This is a catastrophic event. Do you understand? This is Dr. Robert Hamilton from the University of Hawaii, and I'm telling you that a disaster unparalleled in recorded history is about to take place. Do you understand what I am telling you?" The secretary hung up. "What about the international agencies?" Hamilton muttered to his assistant. "Where do we start?" Finley responded. Hamilton suddenly understood. He had tried to stay analytical, to focus, but he stammered at the prospect of what was about to happen. "With something this big, who do we warn?" In the Black Hawk helicopter, Atta Zimler trained his handgun on Joshua. He glanced at his watch. Then Zimler, a man in complete control, smiled at his hostage. "I have 2 minutes. Then we take off. Everything is precisely timed. The Iranians at the Syrian border have a nice little place prepared for you. You thought you were so clever with your clumsy escape from Tehran, but this time I'm handling things. I'm going to help them get the RTS information from you. The Iranians are amateurs. I'm not." Zimler's eyes lit up. "So, Joshua Jordan, the American hero, are you prepared for my brand of pain? Are you prepared to die?" Joshua stared him in the eye. "Funny you should ask. You think I'm joking?" "No, I know you're not. Only this time, us meeting together is different." "Yes, I am prepared to die." "Fine. I can accommodate you. You couldn't possibly understand." Zimler grinned. "Try me." "This time," Joshua began in a quiet voice, "this time I have peace with God." Zimler shook his head. "You're pathetic." "I don't want to die. And if given the choice, you know I'd take your life to save mine." "Now that's the old Joshua Jordan I know." "No, not the old person. I've trusted my life to Jesus Christ. Things are different now." "Different? Really?" Zimler pressed the barrel of the gun against Joshua's cheek. "See," Zimler said, "nothing's different. Nothing's changed, Jordan. Same story. You're the one who's trapped, and I'm the one in control." Something that Abigail always used to say, a favorite phrase, flashed into his brain like a neon sign in Times Square. He bulleted back, "I'll tell you something about control." But he couldn't finish his sentence. Something was happening. The helicopter, which was still idling on the ground, seemed to be swaying slightly. There was a rumbling noise underneath them. Zimmler pulled his handgun away, but kept it trained on Joshua with one hand, while he snatched a pair of handcuffs from under the seat and tossed them on Joshua's lap. "Put them on your wrists." But while Zimmler barked his order, he gave a quick glance out the side window to see what was going on. The shimmying stopped. "I said, put them—" But he didn't finish the sentence. The big jolt came. The Black Hawk tipped crazily down on Zimmler's side at a 30-degree angle. The cockpit door on his side, which he had not yet closed, swung wide open. Zimmler grabbed onto the doorframe to keep from tumbling out. The ground rumbled and shook. The Black Hawk jolted again so suddenly that Zimmler started tumbling out the open door. He was halfway out, but still hung on. Joshua swung around and with his right foot gave a powerful kick to Zimmler's torso, so hard that the assassin's head whiplashed as if he were in a rear-end collision. Zimmler flew through the open door and down onto the rippling, shimmying ground. Zimmler tried to stand, but Joshua could see that the ground was vibrating and shaking too violently. Then another major jolt, this time on the other side, and the helicopter swung back, almost righting itself. Between Zimmler and the Black Hawk, a long, craggy wound ripped open in the earth. There was a deafening thunder beneath the ground, like the groaning of something torn asunder. The gun had fallen out of Zimmler's hand. He jumped backward to avoid the huge crevice, moving farther away from the Black Hawk. Now he was just trying to avoid the abyss that was widening in front of him. There was a look on Zimmler's face. For a millisecond, Joshua saw it. Zimmler looked down at his feet as the rumbling came again, and it was an expression of sheer terror. The earth gave way beneath Zimmler like a collapse of fragile snow, as the ground on which he was standing disintegrated. Zimmler plunged headlong into the crack in the earth. As he tumbled down, his final screams were enveloped in a toxic cloud, the hot gases from the reddish-white column of molten lava that was rising up to meet him. Joshua jumped over to the pilot's seat. He looked at the complex of controls in front of him. "What do I do?" "Think, man. Remember. The cyclic. Grab the stick and get us out of here." With one hand, he pushed the throttle down to power the idling rotors up to maximum speed. Then he grabbed the cyclic stick and tried to pull the helicopter skyward. But it was all too clumsy. And while the helicopter lifted, it started veering off wildly to the side. The helicopter was airborne and was gaining elevation slightly, but at an extreme angle. Joshua jacked the cyclic stick the opposite way, this time tilting the helicopter the wrong way, toward the Syrian border. But his collective control was good, and he was climbing, though he had the nose of the helicopter too far down. He was remembering the finesse he needed on the stick. Slow it down, careful, small touches, and the torque controls as well. The Black Hawk straightened, and he slowly turned it back toward Israel. He torqued the nose back up to a level position, then looked down at the earth opening below him and the rising steam and smoke. He gunned the turbines to full speed. He might just make it. It was starting to come back to him now. He was moving farther into Israel and away from the earthquake tremors back on the Golan. Something unearthly was about to blow. The newest Black Hawks could do 240 miles per hour. He glanced back at the Golan. The whole plateau on the Syrian side seemed to be rising up like a grotesque mountain being birthed with black smoke pouring out of the cone that was forming at its zenith. Then he looked back again and saw another one several miles beyond that, farther into Syria, also belching black smoke. And another smoking cone rising up in the hills beyond that. Like some prehistoric picture of the formation of the earth, the planet seemed to be in the throes of upheaval. Joshua tried to keep the helicopter on course as he gave one final glance back toward the Golan. He saw red fiery bursts of flame and smoke rising up from the Syrian hills. He was no geologist, but the vision of every famous volcanic disaster he had ever read about, multiplied by 10, was now directly behind him. He checked his airspeed. 180 miles per hour and climbing. He knew he had to get clear of whatever was coming next. Faster. Faster. 210. 230. He was about to hit maximum speed, and then it happened. The horizon behind him exploded in a red cloud of fire and flying rock. He could feel a rush of wind punching the helicopter from behind, violently forward and out of control. The Black Hawk's nose dipped forward, and everything shuddered and shook as an explosion of smoke and debris caught up to Joshua's helicopter, and daylight was turned into night.
Chapter 65. General Orogov had no way of knowing that the commanders of Israel's defenses had already resigned themselves to defeat. General Shapiro and those in IDF headquarters had desperately tried to defy the odds. The Israeli forces had thrown themselves at the advancing army with reckless, heroic abandon, but it was now clear that there was simply no chance of victory, not in the face of the coalition's monolithic invasion force that threatened to carpet Israel like a toxic cloud. Orogov had waited long enough. Time was up. He turned to his aide and was about to announce the resumption of the invasion. The general had scoffed at the Russian geologists who had been talking on the phone with him. They had ranted about the possibility of some strange tectonic shift that they were beginning to detect deep within the Earth's core, beyond anything they had ever observed, and that it was likely to hit the Middle East along fault lines and ancient, long-dead volcanic beds. They were predicting the most intense activity in a strange pattern, virtually creating a circumference around Israel's borders. For Orogov, it was ridiculous. Scientists should stick to test tubes and microscopes. Leave the battlefield to me. He opened his mouth to speak, but General Orogov would never give the order. His armored vehicle was suddenly lifted into the air. The major next to him and the driver both screamed. In the back seat, Turkish General Izmet cried out, "What is going on?" General Orogov only had time on his open communication line to yell, "We're under attack!" before he realized that the attack was from the earth below. Their vehicle was on the precipice of a mountain of steaming, smoking rock that was rising up from the ground and into the air. It was undulating like a crazy teeter-totter as it was thrust up higher and higher on the tip of a volcanic mountain that was being birthed in a violent, thundering act of labor. Then the rising stopped. It was quiet for a few seconds. The general frantically tried to open the door to climb out. Then the volcanic cone blew wide open. The armored vehicle containing General Orogov and General Izmet and their staff was blown 2 miles up into the sky in the middle of an expulsion of fire, smoke, spewing lava, and boiling rock. More than 100 MiG jets had been circling the Syrian-Israel border to provide air cover for the advancing troops. There was no radar warning, no escape. The blast from the volcano that was 100 times more powerful than the nuclear detonation over Hiroshima vaporized them instantly. The miles of tanks, troop carriers, ammo transports, and missile launchers had been waiting for a go signal that never came. 500,000 troops had only time to utter a momentary cry of horror, as the sky that seemed to have caught on fire was now falling on them and burying them under hundreds of feet of white-hot ash, lava, and giant pieces of rock. Vehicles tried to bolt off in all directions, but as the tremors shook the earth, the ground opened up under them, and they fell headlong into the deep, shifting crevasses and were crushed like ants in the gears of a grist mill. The long-extinct volcanic regions in Syria, Jordan, and Egypt had suddenly erupted. All of them. Simultaneously, in a coordinated series of explosions that defied all scientific explanation. At the very tip of the advancing front, the colonel in command of the Russian Islamic invasion was watching. He could only see, behind him now, a series of massive columns of smoke reaching up into the atmosphere, and it covered the horizon like a gray, billowing curtain of death. The colonel tried to phone Central Command. Nothing. He tried to call General Orogov's staff, but the lines of communication were down. 1 billion tons of burning debris and gases blown into the atmosphere had disrupted electrical transmissions. The only message from the general to the rear, an interrupted one, was that they were under attack. "This is a trap," he cried. "The Jews have blocked our view with these clouds of dust. They are attacking us from the rear." But the major next to him tried to protest. "Those are our troops behind us, yes?
No, they must have repositioned. That must have been why General Oregov was giving the order to halt. Send the word. Fire our missiles through those clouds so we can kill the Jews before they have us pinned.
3 minutes later, the missile launchers emptied their deadly warheads into the clouds of smoke. What they did not know is that the remaining troops from their own army that had survived the initial volcanic blast were running through the smoke, soot, and ash toward the front in an effort to escape, and right into the barrage of Russian missiles that were now dropping on them with a horrendous series of flashing explosions. The colonel gave the order to retreat in a lateral direction across Israel. They were to head for the sea, but neither the colonel nor the remainder of his army would ever begin the retreat. Earthquakes shook the ground in aftershocks. The earth ripped open under the troops and swallowed them whole. The ring of earthquakes and volcanic explosions spread along Jordan's border with Israel and ran down to the Sinai in the south and into Gaza. There the invading Libyan and Sudanese armies were trapped in the same conflagration of fire and rain of automobile-sized boulders that were dropping from the sky. Earthquakes ripped the ground open underneath their troop lines. Some men, in lighter and faster military vehicles, tried to escape back across the Sinai. But lava flows racing at 50 miles an hour were covering the desert, trapping the fleeing troops and melting the tires of the trucks, and then trapping the screaming soldiers under a tidal wave of liquid fire. The skies along all of Israel's borders were filled with miles-high plumes of smoke and gas. It poured from the mouths of dozens of long-extinct volcanoes that had just been awakened in a frightening fury of power, as if an unseen finger had just flicked a switch. Then flashes of lightning started to appear in the columns of smoke. As the black volcanic ash fell from the sky in sheets, the rains began. Tumultuous downpours at the Syrian borders and at the Jordanian and Egyptian borders as well. And then the hail. Huge hailstones the size of soccer balls came crashing down on the retreating armies. In the monsoon of rain, the retreating trucks and tanks became mired in the mud. The fiery lava raced toward them at heats so high that the falling rain evaporated just above the lava flows. The soldiers on foot tried to scramble for cover from the monster hailstones that were smashing down on them with the force of bowling balls. Out in the Mediterranean, Vice Admiral Trishnipov had lost communication with Central Command, but he was determined not to lose the glory of his grand invasion by sea. So he gave the order. Hundreds of launch boats, full of soldiers, began motoring for the Israeli coast to commence the coastal invasion. The sea was crammed full of Russian ships in Trishnipov's massive armada. Cruisers, aircraft carriers, destroyers, patrol boats, and submarines prowling under the surface. Trishnipov was in the Admiral's bridge when he suddenly saw it approaching. And when he did, the panic that rose up inside of him nearly froze his heart into ice. It told him instantly, intuitively, that there would be no escape. And there wasn't. The colossal seismic disruptions had sent simultaneous shockwaves into the Mediterranean and had caused the high chalk cliffs at Rosh Hanikra at the Israeli-Lebanon border to collapse into the sea. Now, hurtling toward the Russian naval flotilla, was a 300-foot-high wall of water, a tidal wave that was traveling at terrifying speeds and mounting in height along the shallows of the Israeli coastline where the naval armada had anchored. Trishnipov only had seconds to search wildly around the bridge for a life jacket. Maybe, but it would be in vain. The wall of water, as high as a skyscraper, crashed into the huge naval vessels and tossed them around like toy boats in a bathtub. Trishnipov's ship capsized in a 180-degree rotation, and then, while it was upside down, it sank with all hands. Mammoth aircraft carriers rolled onto their sides in one huge groaning motion, while the MiG jets parked on them slid down the upright decks and crashed into the sea. The conning towers of the ships were the last visible sign of the naval invasion, until at last they too disappeared under the rolling waves. In Washington, D.C., Abigail Jordan strode up to the podium at the National Press Club. Phil Rankowitz had set up this event for her on short notice. Abigail hadn't told Harry Smythe what she was about to do. Not that she wanted to blindside her own lawyer,
But she knew Harry. His well-intentioned reaction to her plan might end up inadvertently undermining it. She couldn't take that chance. Abigail Jordan was about to drop a megaton political bomb. She looked out over the room. It was standing room only, and several reporters were shouldering each other trying to get a spot in the doorway. Abigail began. "I will be appearing in federal court in Manhattan tomorrow, charged with a crime, as is my husband, an American hero, who has become a high-value target of a politically motivated, mean-spirited prosecution. Ironically, we have been charged for trying to save Manhattan from a nuclear attack. As it turns out, Manhattan was spared. But tragically, Union Beach, New Jersey, and several small surrounding towns were not, as well as four brave American volunteers who tried to stop that nuclear bomb and who died saving other Americans. Now the real question is this: why do ordinary American citizens, civilians like me, feel compelled to create their own system of national defense? Isn't that the province of our government? It is. Isn't the defense of our nation a first-order priority? It should be. The preamble to the Constitution says that our republic was created to provide for the common defense. Abigail unfolded the piece of paper. She took one more glance at it before she continued. As she looked out at the reporters and television cameras, she saw Phil Rankowitz standing in the back. He nodded in her direction and gave her the thumbs up. "But did our government fail us?" Abigail asked. "Or was my husband, Joshua Jordan, myself and others, were we all exactly what the criminal indictment charges us to be? Reckless vigilantes running a shadow government and guilty of sedition? Interfering with the lawful authority of the United States of America?" She laid the piece of paper on the podium. "I am here because I have been wrongly accused, along with my husband and our close friends. Maliciously charged. But ladies and gentlemen, right here, right now, I bring charges myself. I hereby charge the White House." Then she paused. "No, let me be specific. I hereby charge Jessica Tallroot, sitting President of the United States, with having willfully obstructed an investigation into a real, present, and imminent nuclear threat against our country." The reporters had been instructed in the normal protocol to wait until after Abigail finished her remarks before launching into question and answer. But this was no normal press conference. Hands flew up like those of brokers on a commodities trading floor. Several of them started shouting out her name. She picked one in the front, a female reporter. "You are a trial lawyer yourself, so why have you decided to come out publicly like this? Isn't that abnormal, perhaps even unethical for a lawyer? And where is your attorney? Why isn't he here?" "By my count, you've asked 5 questions. I'll give you one answer. No comment, miss, ever, on my choice of strategy or my relationship with my lawyer." Another reporter shouted out, "Why isn't your husband here to defend himself?" "Because he's over in Israel trying to defend them from annihilation, while I was back here with several patriotic Americans trying to save New York and Washington from annihilation." A female reporter cried out, "The way you talk sounds like you fancy yourself some kind of superwoman. Don't you think that pretending to be a comic book superhero can put citizens at risk, like those poor people in Union Beach?" Abigail had to take a moment before answering. The hostility of the press corps almost took her breath away. "There's nothing super about us or what we were trying to do. Just imagine for a moment. You're walking past a burning house when, to your amazement, you find that the fire department has been ordered not to show up. Tell me, wouldn't you try to save the kids hanging out in the upstairs windows?" Another reporter barked out, "A lot of us consider our firemen to be heroes. So by comparing yourself to them, are you saying that you think you're a hero? Or are you implying that firemen are not doing their job?" "I would have thought that only an Olympic gymnast could do a mid-air twist like that. The way you've twisted my words deserves some kind of gold medal." That evoked a few chuckles from the crowd. But just as quickly, another barb was tossed her way. "It's been said that you and your husband have an agenda to destroy this administration at any cost. Wouldn't you say that the accusations you made today are just more proof of that?"
"Only if my accusations are false."
"Are they?" a voice shouted out. The room suddenly shut down, as if a vacuum had just sucked all the noise out. Someone coughed. More silence. Then Abigail answered, "I have proof, ladies and gentlemen." Then she glanced once more to the paper on the podium. She cleared her throat, took a sip of water, and continued. 2 days ago, I was prepared to tell you that Jessica Tullrood's wrongdoing was limited to collaborating with a Washington, D.C. lawyer by the name of Alan Falsen. She used him to penetrate a lawful organization of patriotic Americans, of which I am one, and she used him to try to maliciously build a case against our group. But then, yesterday, I came into possession of something else, something remarkable. I am about to read you an email from Jessica Tullrood, addressed to Attorney General Hamburg. At the time she wrote it, Miss Tullrood was our vice president. You judge for yourselves whether my accusations are true. Although it was originally encrypted, it was decoded and readable by the highest-level White House staff, including the chief of staff to the president. Here is what it says. Joshua Jordan is a corrupt and untrustworthy source of information regarding an alleged nuclear plot against the United States. His own motives as a private defense contractor, among many other reasons, render his information unreliable and useless. President Corlin's informal remarks about investigating this so-called nuclear plot against America ought to be treated as an aberration, and perhaps another indication of his worsening medical situation. Any investigation that gives credence to Mr. Jordan's nuclear fears will cast doubt about your office, General Hamburg, and your fitness as Attorney General. In a sports bar in Georgetown, Hank Strand, recently resigned White House Chief of Staff, sat with a plate of ribs in front of him. He'd been drinking heavily. Several different ball games were being televised on every one of the web televisions in the place, except one, the TV right in front of Strand. He had demanded that the bartender change the channel on that television, set to the news. He said he was expecting some big news from a press conference at the press club. On the screen, Abigail Jordan was reading Jessica Tullrood's email, which Hank Strand had hand-delivered to her 12 hours ago. When Abigail finished reading the email, the news channel flashed a picture of President Tullrood on the screen. Hank Strand lifted his glass to her image, as if proposing a toast. "Remember, Madam President, loyalty only goes so far." In the White House, President Tullrood was catching Abigail Jordan's press conference, along with her press secretary and new chief of staff. Her profanity-laced screams could be heard all the way out to the White House lawn, where a staffer was walking her French poodle. In the press club, one last hand went up. The reporter was holding the special journalist edition of the All Phone, the one with instant international news and video feeds. "Mrs. Jordan," the reporter called out, "you said your husband's in Israel?"
"Yes. He was taken by force by the Iranians, but he was able to escape and should be back in Israel by now. I heard that yesterday. Hopefully he's joined up with my daughter, who is over there as well. Why do you ask?"
"Mrs. Jordan, there has been some kind of terrible disaster during this invasion of Israel. There's been this massive catastrophe over there. I don't even know how to describe what I am seeing on my video feed. Do you know if your husband is all right?"
Abigail was momentarily at a loss for words. All she could muster was one word. "What?"
Chapter 66. In downtown Jerusalem, thousands flooded the streets. Somber at first, but chattering wildly, asking each other, "What exactly has happened?" They were getting the reports now. Accounts of the destruction of the invaders. At the moment of their near-certain destruction, when the IDF seemed on the verge of obliteration, the borderlands of Israel had exploded. Long-extinct volcanic beds had erupted as earthquakes ripped through the enemy troop lines in the Egyptian desert, in Jordan and Syria. And they were even hearing that the naval invasion off the coast of Israel had been swallowed up in a wall of water from the tremors of the earth. The bewildered crowds now started smiling, hugging, cheering. The minute that Noni and his wife Sari received word at their condo of the destruction of the invading hordes, they joined the cheering crowds in downtown Jerusalem.
Deborah Jordan, Ethan March, and Esther Kinney were fast-stepping along with them, laughing and cheering with the ecstatic mob. By the time they approached Ben Yehuda Street, the whole downtown district had erupted into joyous pandemonium. Music blasted into the square from an open shop. Young Israeli soldiers who still had their machine guns slung over their shoulders danced in the streets with the bearded Orthodox. Affluent brokers grabbed hands with parents who had children in tow. Shopkeepers linked arms with Knesset legislators as they sang wildly together. The cacophony had spread to the adjoining Mesilat Yesharim and King George streets and to every other surrounding avenue. Confetti was shimmering down from the balconies where the apartment dwellers were waving flags of Israel and tossing colored streamers. Everywhere there was laughter and tears. Deborah was crying and singing and laughing in the street along with Esther Kinney and Noni and Sari. Ethan, too, was laughing, but standing off to the side, watching it all. A young man, perhaps 20, a yeshiva student in a hat with the beginnings of a short, scraggly beard, and a girl with him in a long skirt and a babushka on her head, were dancing with their hands in the air. They grabbed Ethan and brought him into their celebration. He humored them with a few awkward steps. Then he raised a hand to say goodbye and stepped away. Before long, the swirling dancing celebration started to quiet down. Hands were being raised. The air was filled with shouts to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, thanking the Lord for the greatest miracle since the parting of the Red Sea, for the most spectacular show of God's power and sovereignty ever displayed before the eyes of the human race. In the crowd, a local messianic pastor in a prayer shawl was looking skyward. His face was radiant, mouth slack, and his eyes looked deeply into an unseen place. He had the look of awe and wonderment that, in his own lifetime, he had just witnessed the culmination of a divine promise. Then, in a triumphant shout, he began to recite the passage from the second chapter of the first book of Samuel, verse 10. Like the twist of a telescope lens, it suddenly brought into focus the image of all that had just taken place. Those who contend with the Lord shall find themselves shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. Then he stopped. Those who contend with the Lord shall find themselves shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. Then he stopped. His voice quivered. There was a catch in his voice as he recognized that the millennia of waiting would soon be over. The pastor finished the rest of the verse with its heralding of Jesus the Christ, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and his coming again in power. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king, and will exalt the horn of his anointed. Esther grabbed Deborah, pulled her aside, and they hugged. Oh, how I wish your dad was here. Deborah nodded with a look that struggled to be optimistic. Surely in the midst of such a great miracle, God would have safely delivered her father. Esther, your husband said he was sure that the helicopter should have picked Dad up on the Golan before the volcanoes and earthquakes, right? Esther hugged her again, but there was so much that they didn't know. On a sidewalk nearby, leaning against a signpost, Ethan was still trying to smile. But the fact was that Deborah had shut the door on their future together. Even when the bombs were dropping and the whole world was exploding around him. And even after that, as all of Israel was breaking into this celebration, he couldn't shake that fact. He had gone through other relationships with women, a lot of them. Why was this so different, so difficult? And another thing baffled him. The stupefying way that this war had ended. He had been a flyer in the U.S. Air Force. For him, battles were won or lost by superior air power, or by overwhelming forces on the ground, or by a winning military strategy. But this, exactly how could he explain the victory here? The word miracle was on everyone's lips. They were shouting it from the rooftops. Why couldn't he? It was as if Ethan was standing on the outside of everything, looking in through some great impenetrable wall of glass. It was as if he were sealed off, a silent witness to the joyous mayhem and the mass worship that surrounded him. Ethan found himself imprisoned in a strange state of isolation, and it rocked him to his core. If it weren't for Deborah, a few feet away, smiling and praying aloud and singing, Ethan would have slipped away from Ben Yehuda Street and set off in the opposite direction, to where he didn't know. At Ramat David Air Base, General Shapiro had received the reconnaissance reports from every corner of Israel. He double-checked the data. It was true. At the point when the battle seemed lost, while Shapiro himself was searching for a photo of his family so he could have it close to him when the end came, that is exactly when the massive enemy invasion was decimated by simultaneous earthquakes and volcanic eruptions that had cordoned off the tiny nation and protected it. The scavenger birds, he had been told, were already flocking to the places where the carcasses of the hundreds of thousands of dead soldiers lay. Yes, that too would have to be attended to. The months and months of burials for all of the enemy dead. And then there would be the cleanup of 100 miles of destroyed military equipment and the mountains of volcanic ash that covered the boundary lands. There was already a rumor about a scientist who had suggested a theory on how to handle that. It might all be burned as a source of energy. Shapiro couldn't bother with that right now. Clearly Israel had been saved. There would be plenty of time for celebration and to ponder the unimaginable that had just occurred. But now was the time for the solemn business of assessing the damage and locating the dead. The airfield had been devastated. From Ramat David alone, Shapiro had lost 32 pilots, along with several of his officers who were killed in the horrendous shelling from the guns on the Jordanian side. Shapiro walked out to the tarmac to survey the scene. The mangled, smoldering wreckage of jets was strewn across the fields. The runway itself was pocked with deep, jagged-edged bomb craters. One of the general's aides trotted up to him. He pointed to the far end of the base where a thin column of black smoke was rising up. "Sir," the aide said, "we've got an aircraft down out there. It just had a bad landing. It's one of ours." They hopped into a jeep and sped to the far end of the airstrip. Shapiro was expecting the worst. One more young, dead IAF pilot. At first, as they approached, Shapiro couldn't figure out what he was looking at. This wasn't an F-16 laying in a heap of smoking metal. The wreckage, he soon realized, was that of a Black Hawk helicopter. Fuel was spilling out where the tanks had been hit by projectiles. The general's jeep pulled to a stop 100 feet away. The dented outside shell of the cabin and fuselage of the helicopter, blackened with oil and soot, looked as if it had been hit with battering rams and then sent through a blast furnace. His aide warned him, "Be careful, General. That fuel could ignite." Shapiro nodded. "Call the fire, guys. But right now we've got to see if there's a live pilot in there somewhere." Then they noticed something. Had the door on the pilot's side of the twisted wreckage just moved? It moved again. Then, with a grinding metallic groan, it opened. A hand reached out. Joshua Jordan tumbled out of the wrecked helicopter and onto the ground. He was blackened with oil and smoke. He slowly raised himself to a half-standing position and tried to limp away from the wreckage. His leg was soaked with blood. Shapiro jumped from the jeep before his aide could restrain him. He rushed up to Joshua and grabbed him, holding him up and preventing him from collapsing. The general shouted out to his aide, "Get a medic here, and I mean now." After the aide sprinted to the jeep and phoned for a medevac, the general, still propping up Joshua, looked back at the smoking wreckage of the Black Hawk. From the burnt scorch marks on the helo, it was clear to the general that Jordan had just come from the area of the volcanic decimation. Then the general muttered something that Joshua was too dazed and in too much pain to hear. "There is no earthly reason you should have survived that." In his hotel room, Curtis Beltether was sitting on the couch. On the coffee table was a package with a mailing label and postage on it. Next to it, Beltether had laid out his notes from his interview with Pastor Paul Campbell, along with his notes from his other interviews, including the one with Alexander Kolikin. He also had a copy of his completed article entitled "The Gods of Climate." The flat-screen internet TV showed images of the ring of volcanic destruction that ran along Israel's borders. Overhead video images showed the miles of incinerated military trucks and tanks that had been destroyed in the wake of the volcanic eruptions. Smoke and steam still rose from the volcanic cones. Beltether studied the screen. The sky cams showed craters and caverns the size of football stadiums, which had cracked open during the earthquakes and swallowed battalion after battalion of the armies sent from Russia and its republics, and from Turkey, Sudan, and Libya. Beltether drummed his fingers on the coffee table as he studied the screen and then glanced down at his notes. He nervously cranked his neck back and forth. Part of him wanted to just step away and get some air, maybe forget what Pastor Paul Campbell had told him as they talked together in New York. But something much more powerful kept him reading those portions of that interview. He knew he didn't really have to reread it. He had that particular interview with Campbell locked in by heart. Now, in light of everything that had happened and the shocking images on TV, how could he ever forget? But he had to read what the pastor had said just once more, just to make sure he wasn't dreaming. During the interview, Campbell had been like a perpetual motion machine. He never stopped. He walked through the outer perimeter of the nuclear blast, ducking in and out of the emergency help centers that his church had provided for the homeless. Beltether was out of breath just trying to keep up. Campbell would occasionally poke his head into the portable radiation scanning tents that the government had set up. He'd thank the workers, who all seemed to know him, and he would spread some encouraging words. But even at that fast clip, Pastor Campbell was deep in thought as he explained it all to Beltether. "There are two great events, preludes to the final stage of the end of days. First, the rapture. Jesus Christ will take his church, and by that I mean every person who trusts in Christ as Savior. Good reason, my friend, for you to make your decision about Christ today. I truly believe it's close. Then after the rapture, the world will experience the worst period in human history, the 7-year tribulation. At the center of it will be the Antichrist, the demonic temporary ruler of the planet who will appear to control it all." Beltether was tracking. "Okay. And the second event after the rapture?" "Bible scholars have argued over whether this second event will happen after the rapture or just before. It's my judgment that it will probably happen before the rapture." "So what's this event?" "I call it Ezekiel's thunder." "You will have to explain that one." "Book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament. One of God's prophets. Chapters 38 and 39. Someone called Gog is described as the leader of a nation called Magog, which is said in the Bible to be a great land in the north. In chapter 38, God tells his prophet that his nation of Magog, which seems to be a clear reference to Russia and its neighboring republics, is going to be the leader of a deadly coalition of Islamic nations. That prophecy tells us that they will come against the nation of Israel in a ferocious war." "Coalition of nations? Like, they are actually named in that part of Ezekiel. You can look it up yourself. Those nations can be identified by matching them historically to their present-day counterparts. Libya today was called Put back then. Then there's Persia, that's modern-day Iran. Kush is described in Ezekiel 2. That would be Sudan today. Gomer and Togarmah, also called Beth Togarmah, those are the areas now in modern-day Turkey, and so is Meshech." "What happens in the war?" "Something amazing. The enemy armies are poised to cover Israel, we are told, literally like a cloud, they are so numerous. There's seemingly no hope for Israel. Then God intervenes in a stunning, incredible, miraculous way. God causes so much confusion that we are told in verse 21 of chapter 38 that every man's sword shall be against his brother. In other words, in the melee created by God to protect Israel, the enemy actually helps to destroy itself, to fire on its own troops."
"So where's the big miracle?"
"Verse 22. Beltether smirked. "Sorry, Reverend, I must have misplaced my Bible." But as he said that, the reporter thought it odd that a memory bubbled up to the surface. That black-covered Bible that his mother gave him for his 12th birthday. He wondered where it was, probably in an attic somewhere or thrown away with his other middle school books. But Campbell wasn't fazed by Beltether's wisecrack. He knew verse 22 by heart. "Ezekiel says that God will destroy the enemies of Israel in that day by great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. And just before that, in verse 19,
We're told there will be great shaking in the land of Israel. So, Mr. Beltether, you tell me, what does that sound like to you?
You're the Bible scholar.
Fire and brimstone? Volcanic eruptions? Shaking of the land? Earthquakes? That sounds logical, doesn't it?
No, actually it doesn't. The whole thing sounds like science fiction on steroids.
That's what the reporter said out loud, at least. But he didn't say what he was really thinking. In a world where the Jersey coast had just been nuked, and where New York City barely escaped destruction itself, Beltether was ready for anything.
Campbell smiled.
When God says he will do a thing, it doesn't matter that he has said it through his prophet 2,500 years ago. If the Lord says it will happen, then it will happen. Then he added, and why will God do it? The Lord makes it clear through his prophet Ezekiel. He does it all to let people like you and folks around the world know that he is God. Right there in Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 23, when all the dust has settled from this miraculous rescue of Israel, the Lord speaks and says, as he does repeatedly in that part of Ezekiel, thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am the Lord.
In his hotel room, Beltether finished looking at his notes from that interview and dropped them on the table. He stared out into space. A shiver ran down his back as if a gentle breeze had unexpectedly brushed against him. Then he shot up from the couch and started rummaging wildly through the dresser drawers. He ran to the bedroom, and from the nightstand he retrieved a Gideon's Bible. He thumbed around in the Old Testament until he finally stumbled on the book of Ezekiel. His hand was shaking. He found this all too incredible and was trying to calm himself. What's the matter with you, Beltether? You act like you're about to meet a ghost. Just read the Bible verses for yourself. Just do it. He sat back down with chapters 38 and 39 of Ezekiel opened on his lap. He read the exact verses that Campbell had cited, the prophecies of Ezekiel given 2,500 years before. There it was in black and white. The description of the exact nations that would come against Israel. The massive size of the invading army. The whole thing would look hopeless from Israel's standpoint. And it would be. Beltether had received the media reports from the warfront. Israel hadn't had a chance. Their own generals were getting ready to die with their boots on because they saw absolutely no hope. But it wasn't hopeless. The unimaginable miracle would happen. Just as the invading forces were entering across the borders, a freakish series of volcanic eruptions and earthquakes had burst through the earth's crust, encircling the tiny country. As if someone had drawn a circle of fire around Israel, as if someone was saying, "You shall not pass." All the details were spelled out in the prophecies of Ezekiel. Brimstone, fire, a great shaking in the land, which is exactly what had happened in the fiery conflagration of volcanic explosions and earth-shattering quakes. Beltether's hands were trembling. Another memory came to his mind. His mother used to walk him as a boy to Sunday school every week. She would quiz him when it was over. "Okay, Curdy boy, what did you learn about the Lord Jesus today?" He was clever enough to spout back what she wanted to hear. But what had he really learned? Then the years of ruthless, hard-boiled cynicism followed, and a life that had taken some rough turns. But he had never forgotten them, those Bible lessons as a child. Maybe he needed to be a boy again to figure this all out. He dropped down to the ground, onto his knees. Curtis Beltether had some unfinished business from 30 years ago. He started praying. "God, it's me, Beltether. We haven't talked since I was a schoolboy and my mom made me go to church camp and Sunday school. That was a long time ago. I remember looking at that picture in the Bible of Jesus on the Sea of Galilee stopping the storm and stilling the waves. I somehow knew back then it was all true, but I walked away anyway. Don't know why. And I've been walking ever since, going nowhere fast. But I'm back. You're too big for me to ignore anymore. I want your son Jesus Christ to take over now. I should have done it long ago, but I'm doing it now. I believe in him, and I need you to save me." When Beltether was done, he stood up. He had to smile. He thought of something. Too bad Mom's dead. She'd be so happy.
Then he snatched the package off the coffee table, blew out of his hotel room, and took the elevator to the lobby. He asked the desk attendant to mail the big envelope for him. Then he added, "This has to go out immediately." Beltether took the elevator back up to his floor. As he did, he couldn't avoid the eerie, unmistakable feeling of completion. Finality.